A second interview with Francis Bunner by himself, November 8th, '88. All right, Francis. I'm interested to get the growth of the chemistry department and the evolution of Stony Brook on its new campus. In other words, let's stay away from Oyster Bay and tell us as much as you can about the evolution of the Department of Chemistry.
All right. Yeah, but let's touch base with Oyster Bay.
All right.
Just briefly at the beginning, what we were talking about last time was the clearing of the atmosphere that had to take place. That in my view was the very significant, crucial role that John Lee played in the history of this institution. I really think that's a very important event. That he was very publicly fired, and he was sent off into oblivion. But the fact of the matter is that as a result of that, the issues did get sorted out, both in Oyster Bay and in Albany, and a clear direction, clear institutional direction was decided. So that by Christmas time, with Tom Hamilton having come down, hand-delivered the approvals of PhD programs in both chemistry and physics, I think in mechanical and electrical engineering as well, we knew at that time that the mandate for the institution was the development of a university, a research-oriented university with graduate programs at PhD level, consistent with the recommendations of the Hill Report. So from then on, we knew how to pursue our planning and immediately began recruitment efforts for graduate students to come, coincidental with the move into the new building on the Stony Brook campus, which was then far along in the construction and scheduled to be completed by the early summer of 1960. That's where we are now, 1960. So we had a restoration of morale, as it were. I mean, the whole thing could have just as easily fallen apart at that point, but we had this, by this time, this really very good nucleus of people in chemistry. We had Fausto Ramirez, Bill Lenoble, Seisa Jishi, Ted Goldfarb, who had come in 58, they came in 59 rather, Bob Schneider and Art Lipley in 60, and Ed Kossauer had joined us in 61. So recruitment of graduate students was our first priority. We had received approval for what was at that time a very substantial equipment request, which gave us good flexibility in recruiting new people. Put us in a position to be able to make major instrumental commitments, which had been rather on the shaky side before that. The recruitment of faculty for 1962 had been substantially compromised by the publicity surrounding the events and what I'm referring to as the clearing of the atmosphere. So we did not do very well in 1962. We were turned down by a number of very excellent people that we had made an effort to hire. One of whom, by the way, was Ben Chu.
What's who?
Ben Chu. He was then a postdoc at Cornell with Peter Debye. And we made a very serious effort to get him to come to Stony Brook in the class of 1962. He turned us down and went to the University of Kansas, but it wasn't many years later that we started getting signals from Kansas that Ben was ready to move east, and we recruited him in 1968. He came to Stony Brook as a full professor, as a matter of fact. So that's how things went. We started with and when we moved onto the campus, 1962, was a mess. The campus was still, buildings were still under construction. It was hard to get in to the buildings. It was hard to walk around in the mud, but there was lots of determination and excitement, and we got moved in. It was a big job. We'd accumulated by this time quite a bit of research equipment. We had active grant-supported research, a number of programs already in motion at that time in Oyster Bay, of whom Fausto and Ed Fausto Ramirez and Ed Kossauer were the leading figures, but by no means the only. The move took place in late summer. Our new incoming class, our first incoming class of PhD students, to the best of my recollection, was about 13 that we recruited that year. We began our first graduate course instruction, and in due course got settled down in the then new chemistry building, which is now officially designated Old Chemistry. The building was working rather well. We had good research space. I told you last time about the minor deceptions that we pulled in the architectural with the architect's knowledge and assistance. We had many spaces labeled preparation rooms, which were in fact full-fledged research laboratories. And so that the department began to blossom in its own facility. It was a major event for us to be able to expand from the very constricted prefabricated laboratory quarters we've been occupying in Oyster Bay to this, at that time, seemingly very spacious and luxurious building. We enjoyed that very much. And continued to work hard. Everybody was working overtime for sure. It was just a big job to get everything moving, teach the new courses. We had an incoming class that was the largest yet. That was another feature of this whole period. Every fall we got more freshmen than we had had the previous fall, and a very high percentage of incoming freshmen in this university have always taken freshman chemistry, so we were always in the position of having to tool up for a larger number of students than we had the year before. It's placed quite a bit of hard work and excitement on all of this. Yeah, the next recruitment this season, 1962-63, we succeeded in recruiting both John Alexander and Paul Latterby. And these were, in both cases, I think, really major coups for the university. John Alexander was, by that time, already a very leading figure in the field of nuclear chemistry, nuclear reaction studies. Being able to recruit him put us on the map in a very solid position for sure in that field.
Where did he come from?
He came to us from Berkeley. He was got his PhD at MIT and had been postdoc at Berkeley and then a regular staff member at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory. So we were pleased to be able to recruit him. Of course, our relationship with Brookhaven was crucially important in that regard. And that's been a very important appointment for us. The other one was Paul Lauterber, who was recruited that same year from Mellon Institute. That was before there was a Carnegie Mellon. He was in the Mellon Institute and was known at that time. He'd had an interesting career because he had only recently earned his PhD degree. but he had already was already known as the father of carbon 13 nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy. He, anybody that knows the literature of that field knows that the first papers ever, first carbon 13 NMR spectra were those of Lauterbur, done at the Mellon Institute, where his where he had developed professionally while being a graduate student at Knight, so he'd taken a long time to earn a PhD at the University of Pittsburgh. So we were very fortunate to be able to recruit him, and our equipment, our ability to buy expensive equipment was an important part of that, because we were able to make a major commitment to a major nuclear magnetic resonance facility for Paul. And of course, Paul went on from there to become the father of nuclear magnetic resonance imaging with his work in the early 70s in imaging. And it's just a damn shame that the university somehow allowed the University of Illinois to steal him away from us.
When did you have your International Conference of Crystallographers?
That conference took place in 1969.
Oh, that late.
Yes, and that was a great event. Also, it was a very nerve-wracking event for those of us that had a major responsibility, because at that time we were, of course, there was still construction going on all over the place, and we were, it wouldn't have been possible without the lecture center, but the lecture center was, completion of the lecture center had been delayed, and so it was nip and tuck whether we were going to have the plenary opening session with Linus Pauling as the principal speaker in the lecture center or not. But there had a lot of cooperation from the contractors, and I guess by that time the State University Construction Fund. And everything was in place, just barely at the last minute, but there was a big and glorious opening plenary session in the big L-100 lecture hall. It was the first event to take place in L-100. So to go on about recruitment in in the 60s, John Alexander and Paul Lauterbur coming, that was a very major event, and we recruited, we got, as the decade of the 60s went on, we seemed to get more lines to fill each year, and we wound up with exhausting recruitment seasons. There was one year in which we made 7 appointments. I've already mentioned Ben Chu. Harold Friedman came in 1965. That was a very major coup for the department and the university. Jerry Whitten about 1967, I think, and numerous young people came as junior starting assistant professors who've made very outstanding reputations, among them Phil Johnson, Dave Hansen, Phil Fowler, and others. I'm not going to try to touch on everybody. It's very interesting. I find it very interesting to note that by the end of the 70s, I remained in the chair for 12 years, so I was the chairman. I had 1 year off for good behavior in 1964-65. I had an NSF senior postdoctoral fellowship and went to Paris for a full year. And Say Tsujishi reluctantly agreed to be acting chairman for that 1 year. So I was chairman from 58 to 1970. I stepped out of it in 1970. And as I just recently had occasion to look over, do an inventory on the present faculty. This is now 18 years later. And the faculty of the Department of Chemistry still consists of more than 50% people that were hired during my chairmanship before 1970.
That's good to have.
So it shows a good, so we've had a good retention ratio of the writing.
The department is well-rounded in the areas. What are the major areas of the department, would you say?
Well, the department's extremely strong in an area I'll just call generally chemical physics, spectroscopy, multi-photon ionization spectroscopy is a method that Phil Johnson had actually invented. It was his contribution to chemical physics here at Stony Brook. It's become a very major method in spectroscopy. So we're very strong in the general areas of physical chemistry and chemical physics. In theoretical chemistry, we have a very great strength in statistical mechanics. That's where Harold Friedman has made very major contributions. Gerard Stell has been at the university for a long time, always affiliated with the chemistry department, but his major appointment was in the mechanical engineering department. But he, just a few years ago, became a full-time member of the chemistry department. I guess maybe he severed his connection to the engineering college. And he's a very major, what's that?
How do you spell his name?
S-T-E-L-L. He's a very major figure in statistical mechanics. So we have very great strength there. And our other theoreticians are Jerry Whitten, who's now making major contributions to quantum mechanical applications to surfaces, and Dick Porter, who has always, his field has been the chemical and theoretical aspects of chemical kinetics. Very fundamental way. In organic chemistry, we had very outstanding strength with Fausto Ramirez and Ed Kossauer. Those guys, unfortunately, didn't get along with each other very well, or with others in many ways, and organic chemistry did not flourish as it should have with fine scientists, as excellent scientists as they were at the top, but we did not flourish as well as we should have. Bill Lenoble, of course, his career has developed here. He came here determined to play a major role in applications of high pressure to the kinetics of organic chemistry. And he has become one of the leading figures internationally in that field. And he's an associate editor of one of the major journals. There's been a very major career there that has developed here. Ed Kossauer left us a number of years ago for Israel. He went to the University of Tel Aviv. And in recent years, we have developed the very great strength in organic chemistry, where it's really very strong, where some of the more recent appointments have been made. Fausto retired coming up three years ago. Is unfortunately in a very poor condition, having had a very serious stroke.
I interviewed him before he had his stroke.
Yes. Apparently. Inorganic chemistry is another area in which we've had substantial strength, not the most outstanding, but very good people.
Okay. What about the context of the department? In other words, the university-wide structure, faculty life, quality of students, that sort of thing. That is the institution as an association of scholars.
Well, Stony Brook has always suffered from a kind of compartmentalization that could be slower. Since we came, well, Not since we came to Sunnybrook. We started out in Oyster Bay, of course, with everybody on top of everybody else. And aside from the effects of polarization, which were very severe in Oyster Bay, and which pursued us to a certain extent here in Sunnybrook as well, we had very good communication, and it was, when the place was smaller, you felt that you knew just about everybody. And that was good. Physics and chemistry are all mixed up with each other. Very close relations among physics and chemistry. We came out here and got into separate buildings. Well, we had faculty dining room facilities for a long time, and that was a place where people got to know each other and came together. But that went out a number of years. Remember, we had a faculty dining room. I was eating with you over there.
Yes.
In H Club. That was good. But that went out, and...
Well, I moved over to the Union. And for a while, there was a separate room for faculty.
Yeah.
There was some good feeling. Remember that?
Yes. And then, I guess, in the late 60s, that was became too elitist.
Yes.
They had to open it up for students.
Yes.
Sorry. Yeah.
And then they tried the dining room on the second floor of the campus. New chemistry problem.
And that worked very well, but then it folded. It wasn't economically viable.
Economically,
I think it was sabotaged by the DACA food service people.
Oh?
Well, yes, they put up the end of the bridge restaurant in Union Building, and that became, was put in position of being a direct competitor. And, what was called the senior common collapsed. And that was really very unfortunate. So faculty of this university tend to be brown baggers. I do more brown bagging than anything else, actually, myself. And so the faculty, the various component parts of the faculty don't know each other as well as they should. And that's unfortunate. So it's, I think within departments, I think there's a high degree of collegiality. Not all departments, is my impression, but certainly in our department, I guess. Student body, coming through the late 60s and into the 70s, I felt that we had a very high average quality student body. In more recent years, that's gone down seriously.
Do you have any idea why?
In order to maintain enrollments, with declining applications, we've had to, the admissions office has had to go down to a lower standard, admission standard.
We don't have a very large admission staff, so we don't really do much active recruiting.
I think our admissions has been very seriously deficient for many years. It's an old story. I don't know why that problem wasn't faced head on a long time ago, but it's been a very serious problem. We had the famous drug raid of 1968 that plagued us for many years, and still plagues us. I think we've developed a certain reputation that has hung on in among high school guidance counselors. Long Island students are counseled to go elsewhere routinely, and I don't think our admissions office has been very effective at countering that.
What about graduate students?
Graduate student recruitment has been very tough, and it's become increasingly difficult to recruit domestic students because they're getting to be less and less of them. And it's so that the best foreign students is even a very severe competition among the best graduate schools in the country. With them. We have had consistently, each year we have had some very good graduate students. We have many of our own PhDs out there in very good positions that we're very proud of and made very fun contributions. We were up to the level, in chemistry, we're up to the level of recruitment that we like. It's of the order of 30 to 35 new students each year. And the quality level among foreign students, very high and very satisfactory. Not as the numbers of, I think the numbers of domestic students probably hanging around something like 50%. But I'm not sure that the quality level among the domestic students is holding up as well as it should.
What about the kind of support that the department has received from the administration?
Well,
and from Albany itself. Have you had any connections with people in Albany?
Well, I was for 12 years a member of the Board of Directors of the Research Foundation.
Of the Research Foundation?
Yes.
In Albany?
Yes.
This is Mark Grant's operation.
Well, it was a long time ago.
All right. That's me.
I was appointed to the Board of Directors of the Research Foundation in 1976. As a representative of the faculty, principal investigators. And I was appointed to a 3-year term, and with one thing or another, I thought it was appropriate for me to get off after 3 terms. I twisted my arm. I wound up serving 4 terms on that board. And it was very satisfying for me, because one of the things that concerned me a lot, going way back to Oyster Bay now, when we first started to get research grants, I was concerned about where does the overhead come. So every faculty member who gets a grant, of course, realizes that a very high percentage of the funding that comes from the federal agency goes into the overhead. And we were working through this remote agency that none of us knew anything about, the Research Foundation of State University of New York. This funding was all carried through that agency. The funds were paid to them. And we weren't seeing any of that indirect cost income at all.
We were probably contributing a large proportion.
It became a large proportion. It was a drop in the bucket in the earliest years, but then it kept growing, and it became to be very substantial indeed. We're now the biggest. Our contribution to the overhead, total overhead earnings, is the biggest of any campus. But there was very little of it coming back to campus. It was, what was coming back in the early 60s was, all the way through the 60s, was called, what was called OR5 income. And that was strictly to compensate the campus for the administrative costs on local campus, the cost to the local campus of administrative costs. Grants. So that was there for grants management, personnel, and strictly administrative costs. And none of that was going back for principal investigators who were bringing in the money and felt that it was riding on their backs. Could see it in any way. And it was still like that in 1976 when I became a member of that board. And
were you able to change it a little?
It's changed enormously. Every time that I've been on the board, and I'm given a lot of credit for that, and not so much in Stony Brook, but in Albany.
Yes,
the Cliff Wharton's chancellorship made a big difference. He allowed that to happen in ways that I don't think his predecessors would have. Because the chancellors, like Ernie Boyer and Sam Gould before that, would come into office as chancellor and find that they had effectively no discretionary funds whatsoever. They had no flexible funding that they could work with, just the way the state, New York State budget process works. So they did have, through the Research Foundation, was money coming in outside the state treasury, which they could
lay
their hands on, and of course we're reluctant to give that up. And one thing that changed it was that Controller Leavitt, he was the controller of state of New York for many years, and he had a consistent campaign over many years to get that money redirected into the treasury, where it would have state spending controls on the money, and that would of course been bad for everybody. So bit by bit, we were able to get the get funding directed back to campus, and it's now at quite a high percentage. I can't say that I'm satisfied with what happens on the local campus. In recent years, it's been less and less of it coming back to the departments where there should be a high percentage of it going to the departments that generate it, in my view. And that has been cutting off in recent years in ways that I regret. So I just went off that board the farewell celebration for me was last March in Albany. But of course I did get to know a lot of people in the central administration through my membership on that board.
Who are some of the people in the central administration that perhaps I ought to interview with respect to the growth of Stony Brook?
I don't know. Have you planned to interview Wharton?
Wharton? I have not, simply because of his coming in very late. But maybe I should.
Yeah, he came in, I must have been 70. Was it 76 when he came in?
I don't know.
I guess it must have. No, I know, it was 78.
He succeeded Ernie Boyer.
When I went on the board, it was Boyer. Then Boyer left, I think, in 77, and Jim Kelly was acting chancellor for a year.
And then Wharton came in just about the same time John Toll left.
That's correct. Wharton came in 78. That's what happened. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, in answer to your question about the growth of research, of course, you said, you mentioned Mark Grant. Mark Grant was put on a sidetrack in the Research Foundation shortly after Wharton came. And administrative organization changed around. So Mark Grant was, I guess, for a while, executive vice president. A man named Paul Silverman, who was there for just a relatively short time, was president of the Research Foundation. And when Silverman left, Mark Grant was effectively put on a golden parachute sidetrack. Rather cruelly, actually. Much as he was a source of much difficulty and much ill feeling between campuses and Stony Brook, he had a high-handed way of handling things that did create a lot of ill feeling, especially here in Stony Brook. But even so, I don't think that the way he was treated, like Horton, was particularly humane. The person that succeeded him as executive vice president was John Buckhorn.
John what?
Buckhorn.
B-U-C-K-H-O-F-F.
And John Buckhorn has done a very excellent job in that position. And he has guided that foundation through a major transition, in which responsibilities and funding have been spun off to campuses in a very major way. And John Buckhoff has witnessed the growth of Stony Brook. I think he has good perspective on it, but he hasn't witnessed it from way back, which you might want to consider interviewing him.
You know anything about the reviews of the department, either by the Middle States people or by the National Association of Chemical?
The American Chemical Society.
American Chemical Society. You know how the department has been regarded?
Well, the American Chemical Society has an accreditation program. They don't call it accreditation, but a certification. And so it was way back in the early days. I forget whether we were still in Oyster Bay or just recently moved to Stony Brook when we were ready for our first evaluation by the American Chemical Society. It's called the Committee on Professional Training. And they sent their inspector, who was a professor at MIT. And we got very
inspector.
No, his name was...
It's
funny.
But he was from MIT.
He was from MIT. I don't remember lots of names. But that's funny, I knew the guy. And he was a very, very good person and did a very thorough inspection and gave us a very high recommendation. I did give...
Was it in writing and would the department have a copy of it?
It was in writing and the department should have a copy of it. Whether the department can locate it or not, I really don't know. But,
about what year was that?
Well, it would be either 61 or 62. I did get criticized. Well, I got criticized as chairman, and the department got criticized. In that report, and we've had, and it has happened subsequently also, because we don't have any faculty or programs that are explicitly called analytical chemistry. And it so happens that the professor from MIT that inspected us that first time was a professor of analytical chemistry at MIT. And this is something that was deliberate on my part in building the department, and something that many people agree with very strongly, and particularly people that came here. It was a big attraction for Ben Chu, for example. That this was always my view that analytical chemistry, that we all have to be analytical chemists. So we haven't recruited people that call themselves analytical chemists. And if you look at the American Chemical Society Director of Graduate Research, which lists all the departments, faculty and their research programs one by one. You look at some of the major departments like Harvard and Berkeley, you notice that that's the same way, that there aren't people that call themselves analytical chemists. It doesn't mean that they don't know how to do analytical chemistry, but in order to do any kind of chemistry, you have to be analytical. So we have had criticism for that. And there may be some ways in which it's hurt us also, because people, there is certainly a major profession out there for chemical analysis. In fact, I've had a couple of my own graduate students who have, one of my PhD students went to University of Georgia to be a postdoc with one of the major analytical chemists of the country, well qualified as an analytical chemist. And a couple of them, he and another one, are working now for the U.S. Geological Survey, where their concern is water quality on the island, and it's essentially analytical. Well, that's not very important.
Okay. Do you know anything about the reports that we got by the 10-year Middle States Association review?
I don't.
I think the first one was in 63. The first one was in 63, or it was late 62. And the leader was the chap from Rochester, who had been the chairman of the review committee that did Bucknell the year before.
Oh.
So
you were familiar?
I was familiar with it.
I don't recall there ever having been anything explicit about chemistry in those middle Atlantic States reviews.
Any other international conferences besides crystallography?
I certainly never wanted to take on another one after that. That was a very nerve-wracking thing, and it's a question of what infrastructure, administrative infrastructure, does Stony Brook have to field things like that? And we've never done very well. There's a feeling about Stony Brook that if anything can go wrong, it probably will. It's sometimes people call it Murphy's Law. There seems to be a regulation of Stony Brook. I always used to worry about the first person that was going to have surgery in our university hospital. I don't know who it was, but they seemed to have survived very well.
The hospital has done very well. It's been about 450 beds in operation.
Yeah.
Okay. Have any feeling about the 3 years that I was in charge?
Well, I have very warm feelings about those years, and speaking personally, there was a time when I felt that I couldn't have been supported better. I felt I was extremely well supported in my efforts and what I was trying to do, and having a supportive administration behind me made it possible to bring on some of these, what I still consider major tools in recruitment. People like Alexander, Lauterberg, Friedman, Chu. Well, Chu was later, but Alexander, Lauterberg, Friedman were all recruited during that time, in that period. And I remember Charlie Cooper, who was business officer under you, is that right? Charlie Cooper was so supportive. I couldn't have asked for better budgetary support than we got during that time. He had reflected great confidence in me and what we were doing. And I really appreciated that a lot. And I've always felt that I had your confidence. And Stan Ross was very supportive and very helpful.
Ed Price, did you know him?
I never...
vice president for personnel in the central office.
I think I must have met him, but he never loomed large on my horizon. The people that people that loomed large on my horizon were, as I said in the last interview, Harry Porter, had quite a lot of direct personal dealings with him, and Milton Lewis. Charlie Foster. Was another one.
Yeah.
Did you get him on your
list? Yes, I did, but he's one of the first of them, and I really probably should go back to him now that I know a little bit more about what questions to ask. He's retired, of course. Milton Lewis. I don't know where he is.
I have no idea.
Okay.
Now, of course, at that time, another thing that happened when the air got cleared. Now, I'm talking 1962 now, early 1962. We're going to move to the new campus, and we're going to recruit graduate students, and we're going to go full speed ahead. A major event that happened then was the arrival of Alec Pond.
Yep.
And that was, I think I played a major part, major role in the recruitment.
Did you?
Of Alec Pond.
And where Harold?
What's that?
Tell me how.
Well, Alec had to be persuaded that the thing was going to go. Right. I mean, and that was tough because, as I said, we were having no luck in recruiting people from the chemistry department in that year because we just went through this horrendous event. So it was a question of helping, getting people to see through all the smoke that was going to clear.
Yeah.
Conviction that it was going to clear and that we were going to, that we did have a major opportunity in our hands. And I think I spent a lot of time with Alec during those, I think it was the early months of 62 that he was considering it. Leonard Eisenbud had made it known that he did not wish to continue in the chair of the physics department. And he hadn't been the most vigorous